I'm Seth, and this is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Cresswell. First up this week, we've got Elvis Presley and Mystery Train from 1955. To the Farewell to Sun, Mystery Train was the latest A-side Elvis recorded for Sam, or the last A-side Elvis recorded for Sam Phillips' label. The session took place in July 1955 with Presley's usual sidemen, Scotty Moore on guitar, Bill Black on bass with drummer Johnny Thing. The song was written for Little Junior Parker by a Southern blues singer who recorded it for Sun as Little Junior Parker and his Blues Flames in 1953. Writer and academic Grail Marcus has written extensively about this song and links that it provides along running through American music like the mighty Mississippi. His book Mystery Train is great, though it's unlikely that anything as profound as running through the minds of half a dozen people in that small Memphis studio on that hot evening. Mystery Train is perhaps the doom that awaits us all across the dark prairie night, or it may just be the promise of adventure. It was the greatest thing I ever did on Elvis, Phillips has said. It was the feeling of that song. I mean, it was the big thing. I put a loved one on a train and they're leaving forever. Perhaps they'll never come back. It's pure rhythm. And in the end, he was laughing because he thought he'd screwed it up. Far from it. Mystery Train was Elvis's first number one country hit. Phillips, facing bankruptcy, now had an asset he could sell, and RCA paid him $35,000 for the last year and half on Elvis's contract. According to New York songwriter Doc Primus, the first time, how do you do? Oh God, I haven't done a New York accent for such a long time. The first time I heard of Elvis Presley, it was 1955. I was singing in this joint called 70th Street, called the Musicale, when I heard this jukebox called the Mystery Train, and I just couldn't believe it. It sounded like someone just came out of the swamp. It was just the most fascinating record for me. So it's Elvis Presley, Mystery Train. You're listening to Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4, and I just told you what the track is. I didn't. Maybe if I didn't, I can't remember. Anyway, it's Elvis and Mystery Train. That was Elvis and Mystery Train. You're listening to Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4 FM. I'm Seth, and this is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Cresswell. Now, it's usually about this time of the show, and I think I said it's usually about this time of the show the other week, so it's usually about the time that this time in the show that I say that it's usually about this time in the show that I say that... when Toby Cresswell selected these songs, he didn't select them necessarily as the best songs of all time, full stop, end of story, be all and end all, that's the phrase I'm looking for, be all and end all. He didn't select them like that. What he was, after doing, actually, when he selected these tracks, was trying to sort of say what was the most, tracks were most influential on music over the last, give or take, 100 years. Some of the tracks he said himself, some of the tracks were truly awful. Well, what tracks you think are awful, well, I'll leave you to decide. But I might find it irresistible to let you know when the tracks that I think are awful. But when we just face that problem when you come to it, won't we? What the next track that you're going to have to make your mind up on, that old Toby Cresswell there selected, sitting in his Sydney study, somewhere in Sydney, there is The Kinks and Lola, which is from 1960, and it appears on the album Lola versus Power Man, and the Money Go Round. Yes, I'm doing very well tonight, aren't I, with this whole reading thing. It's very new to me, you know, this whole reading thing. Usually I just use hieroglyphs. It didn't work. If I used hieroglyphs, I'd probably know how to say hieroglyph. Didn't work. Sorry, people. One of the most controversial songs of its time, Lola, was the first pop hit about transsexuality. Ray Davies tells the tale of a man in a nightclub that goes home with a woman who may well be a man. Not surprising now, perhaps, but in 1970, this was certainly new territory for pop music. Lola had the ring of a documentary to it. It has been reliably reported that Davies did date Candy Darling, one of Andy Warhol's superstars at the factory. Darling was one of the famous transvestites and still... was even made more widely known by Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side. I wonder if he I can't actually know if Mr. Cresswell put that in there, you know, but it's the one that goes out in the colored guns. Clarinet solo. Anyway, the line he's referring to in that song is, "Candy once, never once gave it away. Everybody had to pay and pay. But she never lost her head, even when she was given head." It's only because that song's mildly dirty that I know all the words to it. But anyway, Davies commented on the relationship. It's a stubble that gave it away. The stubble. It was the stubble. Candy's stubble. That gave it away. My mistake there. Ha ha. The Kinks turned in this amazing take on the signal, the best riff since You Really Got Me, one equally steamy. It was so good that radio had to play for the 45 despite the subject matter. Only the BBC got their break up about the lyric. They insisted that Coca-Cola be changed to Cherry Cola because they couldn't be seen to advertising a soft drink. Actually, I'm not sure which set of lyrics, whether it's the BBC censored version or not, that we've actually gotten here, but you just have to find out, won't you? This is Waiheke Radio, 103 and 107.4. I would have sounded quite good if I had got the number right. You know, something like that. Basically, what I was trying to get across artistically there was the fact that we are broadcasting right here as Waiheke Radio, 88.3 or 107.4 FM. And that was The Kinks and Lola from 1970. Now, next up, we've got Leonard Cohen. I am picking up a certain keenness on Toby Crespo. Well, actually, he's keener on Elvis and Chuck Berry and a number of other people. But, well, he is also quite keen on Leonard Cohen. This is his 1988 track called Tower of Song. Emerging from 4 years of silence, Cohen's I'm Your Man album was full of dry humour at his own expense, lustful songs about women, and a new keyboard-paced sound that it was part chanson. Does anyone here know what chanson means? Am I even pronouncing it right? I ever reckon it's something French. I don't know. I did French for a couple of terms at school, but I've forgotten most of it now. Really? Apart from Comment ça va. Oh no, I've lost my place. Somewhere here. Found it. In part Kraftwerk. And I think, well, actually, we've got some Kraftwerk coming up. We've got that one, you know, that goes fun, fun, fun on the Autobahn. You know, like that. But anyway, this gem of that album was immensely witty, Tower of Song, which placed the singer in the delightful imprisonment of his muse. This was my story, he told an audience at the time. This is a dismal story, it's a shabby story, it's a funny story, but it's my story. Increasingly, Cohen devoted himself to the service of his life as a whiskey-drinking Zen monk and related his writing to the religious practice and vice versa. If you're going to think of yourself in this game or in this tradition and you start getting a swelled head about it, then you've really got to think about who you're talking about. He said in 1994, you're not just talking about Randy Newman, who's fine, or Bob Dylan, who's sublime. You're talking about King David, Homer, Dante, Milton, Wordsworth. You're talking about the embodiment of our highest possibility. So I don't think it's particularly modest or virtuous to think of oneself as a minor poet. I really do feel the enormous luck I've had in being able to make a living and to never have had written one word that I didn't want to write. But I don't fool myself. I know the game I'm in. When I wrote about Hank Williams, 100 floors above me in the Tower of Song, it's not some kind of inverse modesty. Oh, there's a text there. Well, I'll leave you with Leonard Cohen and a Tower of Song so I can reply verbally to this text. I bet the person who sent this text is thinking, oh, damn, now. Or maybe not. Maybe they just wanted to shut me up. Anyway, I won't know until I read it. So here's Leonard Cohen and Tower of Song.
Well, my friends are gone. And my hair is gray. I ache in the places where I used to play. And I'm crazy for love, but I'm not coming home. I'm just paying my rent every day in the Tower of Song. I said to Hank Williams, how lonely does it get? Hank Williams hasn't answered yet, but I hear him coughing all night long. Oh, 100 floors of me in the Tower of Song. I had no choice. I was born with the gift of a golden voice and 27 angels from the great beyond. They tied me to this table right here in the Tower of Song. So you can stick your little pins in that voodoo doll. I'm very sorry, baby, doesn't look like me at all. I'm standing by the window where the light is strong. How they don't let a woman kill you, not in the Tower of Song. Grown bitter, but of this you may be sure. The rich have got their channels in the bedrooms of the poor, and there's a mighty judgment coming, but I may be wrong. You see, I hear these funny voices in the Tower of Song. I see you standing on the other side. I don't know how the river got so wide. I loved you, baby, way back when. And all the bridges are burning that we might have crossed, but I feel so close to everything that we lost. We'll never have to lose it again. Now I bid you farewell. I don't know when I'll be back. They're moving us tomorrow to that tower down the track, but you'll be hearing from me, baby, long after I'm gone. I'll be speaking to you sweetly from a window in the Tower of Song.
Leonard Cohen and Tower of Song. Now, Mr. Fox, apparently, you know, down at his rubbish dump, his five-star rubbish dump where he keeps all his children's records and CDs, he's managed to dig a dictionary out of there, and he's done a bit of research, done a very good bit of research, actually, and found out that a chanson is actually a song. So thank you very much for that, Mr. Fox. You're listening to Waiheke Radio, and we're on 88.3 and 107.4 FM. I'm Seth, and this is 1001 Songs, the greatest songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Cresswell. Now, Next up, we've got Lucinda Williams. People know Lucinda Williams, and she wrote that song called Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, and she said that she moved around a lot as a kid because her dad was teaching in different places, but she said that she also thought it was part of the American folklore tradition that she had a sense of some places where she'd like to be, but she didn't know if she'd ever settle down that long in one place, and that she'd probably always be kind of moving around. On this, her fifth proper studio album, which was titled Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, so this is the title track here that I'm about to play, Williams uses the landscape, especially the American South, as a canvas for her long emotional journey. The roadside is littered with lost loves and death. The final result, though, is greatly uplifting. Williams recorded the album three times. One of the producers, Steve Earle, described it as the least amount of fun I've ever had working on a record. So if you'll just excuse me, I'm just going to go off and cry now. No, I'll just edit that last bit in. Thought it worked quite well with the voice. I don't know. The end result is both strong and sublime. Longtime producer Gerf Morlix had a go, and finally E Street Band keyboardist Roy Britton polished the record into a classic. There's a relentless, hungry feeling to Williams' work. She throws herself into a situation, feet first, and then clambers out of there, wipes off the scars, and moves on. Car Wheels on a Gravel Road is told from the perspective of a young girl who's in the backseat watching her parents' relationship disintegrate, and it's not too much of a leap to suggest that the lessons at the knee were carried out through her work. Rarely do songwriters get this close to the bone without self-pity and with compassion. Car Wheels delivered, with help from friends like Earl and the great Buddy Miller, on Williams' promise. The album won a Grammy, topped the prestigious Village Voice poll, and took Williams out of the shadows. Clearly it was worth the wait. There. Lucinda Williams, ladies and gentlemen, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. I think this might actually be a live version, but I'm not sure. I think it might have been off a TV show.
Car Wheels.
That was Lucinda Williams there, and car wheels on Gravel Road, Waiheke Radio right here, 88.3 and 107.4. Next track is The Eels and Grace Kelly Blues. This is from the 2000 album, Daisies of the Galaxy. Tom Waits described The Eels as electric Jungian therapy. I don't know what Jungian is, but it's on a vintage pawn shop instruments, tribal grooves, and garage energy. The Eels are outsider-like folks that paint with fingernail polish. They eagerly await each new release. What's not to like about cheap microphones, distortion melody, and great songs? That accolade made Mark Oliver Everett happy for 3 days. Everett, a.k.a. E, who for all intents and purposes is the whole band, is not always a happy guy. Both his parents died early and his sister committed suicide. E is accustomed to depression and grief, but Grace Kelly Blues, which opens with the album Daisies of the Galaxy, is a wonderful song about acceptance. The new folk tag is not far off. He sounds like Beck with an R&B groove, and there is a sweet and positive tune to go with the spirit of the lyrics. To me, these are happy records, he told LA Weekly. The most positive records I have ever made. I think that Electroshock Blues, largely about his sister's suicide and his mother's impending demise, is even more positive than Daisies. And a hard won victory, but it's a victory, you know. You have to think about how much trouble it is to, you know, get up every day and make a record like that. If you're passionate about something, you're gonna do pretty good. He wound up in Los Angeles, where he met Larry Waronker, something like that, who's a producer and patron of Randy Newman. Waronker, no doubt, recognized in E the same acerbic wit and dark humor that had been Newman's stock in trade. While E's records are obviously personal, they are not specifically conventional, and therein lies their longevity. Well, when you end up with the mask of another's point of view, you get more daring and end up revealing more, he said. Often people thought it was about whining about my life for 12 songs, but it's different people whining about their lives. That's Eels and Grace Kelly Blues from the 2000 album Daisies of the Galaxy. And I'm just using... here we go.
His heart is a brick. Taking your order. so sure when I got here around. Sun melt in the fake, smile away. I think you know I'll be okay.
That song sounds like it should be out of, you know, one of those films, you know, where, you know, somebody called something like Cindy Nathan or someone, and she's just got her dream job, but then she's also just split up with her boyfriend, and she's all feeling dismal and depressed, and it's raining, and she's walking down the road soaking wet, and then her boyfriend gets out of a taxi with a bouquet of flowers, and they have one of those artistic long shots, you know, where you see the water running down the drain, and you see them sort of reuniting above, and she's all soaking wet and everything, and... You know, I'm not an aspiring film director, actually. I don't even like films that much. I just an idea I had. You are listening to 1001 Songs, the greatest songs of all time, or not necessarily, but, you know, the reasonably influential songs over the past 100 years. I think he, when he wrote that title, he didn't want to water it down too much, because maybe you couldn't get it published. But... basically, it was written by this music journalist called Toby Creswell, and is presented by yours truly. I'm Seth, by the way, in case you hadn't already heard that famous piece of gossip there. Now, speaking of gossip, actually, we've got Everybody's Talking with Harry Nilsson. I didn't do that on purpose, honestly. I just looked down at what was the next track, and I just mentioned gossip, and there was Everybody's Talking. It's quite funny how things work out that way, isn't it? But anyway, Derek Taylor, the legendary Beatles publicist, sang Harry Nilsson's praises. Well, so he's a vocalist as well as a Beatles publicist. Yeah, that was just me trying to be funny there. Now I've lost my place trying to be funny. Don't stop. Just concentrate, Seth. Concentrate. To director John Schlesinger, who was looking for songs for his upcoming film, Midnight Cowboy. The track he picked from Nilsson's second album, Aerial Ballet, with a version of Fred Neil's Everybody's Talking... Oh, well, basically, you know the song. It's just, you know, that one goes, everybody's talking about it, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, only the echoes of my mind, I'm going where the sun, you know. Anyway, I'll find you this song. Oh, I haven't got it here. Yeah, sorry about that. Anyway, you know the song. You know the song. I will see if I can find it for you. But actually, what I've found here is El Green and Let's Stay Together. Let's Stay Together was El Green's second number one hit. It was more softer vocal from the Sam Cooke devotee. But the groove was more complex. All my life I've attempted in jazz chords, said producer Willie Mitchell one Saturday afternoon. I was tampering around on the piano, and I came up with this melody for Let's Stay Together. I played it for Al on the piano, and Al Jackson was playing drums and with his hands creating the rhythm. So Al said, give me 5 minutes, and I'll write some words to it. About 15 minutes later, he came back with a song with some words, and we started messing with the song, and about a week later, they put the track down. Mitchell's approach to recording was keep it funky and keep it simple. Lyrically, the song is not simple. It has a prismatic view of relationships. It is over, and he wants it back, as this is a song about devotion. Mostly, the answer is in the groove. Purely a love song that is as multifaceted as love itself. He really does know this whole emotional thing, doesn't he, Mr. Creswell there? Mr. Creswell, the Australian music journalist. The song has been widely covered, but it never with the same style and smoothness of Green's original. Once in a after a performance, Green recalled, this couple walks up to me, they say, about 47 years old, and they're holding hands and smiling. They say, you know, we're newlyweds, and the reason for us getting married is that song you done, Let's Stay Together. Now that's what I call getting through. Al Green and Let's Stay Together. Sorry, but I couldn't actually find that song. You know the song, though, so don't worry, because you know it. Yeah, that was Al Green there. And Let's Stay Together. Next up, we've got Janis Joplin, you know, with Big Brother and the Holding Company, you know, and their album Sex and Dope and Cheap Thrills, which, as I believe it was originally called until the government, the American government, shortened it just so it was Cheap Thrills because they thought that the rest of it was a bit, you know, explicit. And the censorship board says, no! But anyway, there is a track on that, actually. Called Summertime, and recorded in 1968, and it was George Gershwin's exquisite ballad from Porgy and Bess. I like a bit of Gershwin, don't you? I'm singing a lot tonight. I wonder why I'm singing. Maybe I'm in good spirits for some reason. I don't know why. Oh, that's why I'm on holiday, that's right. Just remembered I'm on holiday here, it's Easter and everything. And it has been rendered by so many great artists that it stands out as one of the true high points of the 20th century's song. Janis Joplin understood exactly why she included it in the Big Brother set. The recording of Cheap Thrills, the second Big Brother album, was fraught with tension. The producer, John Simon, was extracting perfectionist, but in background... with a background in classical music, with blessed with perfect pitch. Jealous. Big Brother, on the other hand, could barely and really tune their instruments. In between two was Janis Joplin, full of ambition for the recording and loyalty to her band. Much of the album was soulful, bluesy feel that made Joplin's reputation. There was some psychedelic reading of Gershwin's sublime melody there. Sam Andrew, who produces the song with his own arrangement of Bach's Prelude in C minor, probably from the 48 there. If you want to find out more of the 48, you want to tune into Variations on a Theme with Mark Smith. It's on at 11 o'clock on Sundays, I believe. I can't quite see it on the timetable, but that's when I believe it is on. Variations on a Theme with Mark Smith, ladies and gentlemen. Excellent show. Actually, I promote that a lot. I think that it's because of all the... Every time they refer to some classical music, I seem to promote that. Just getting some, you know, self-awareness here. Yeah. According to Simon, the band seemed to think you could stimulate Bach when each musician played a stream of steady quavers. They hadn't paid much attention to the fact that quavers, or eighth notes they've got here, but the non-American version's quavers. But if you're American, it's eighth notes. Yeah, they're the ones, you know, that are black, and they have the stick going up, and then they have the little tail. Yeah, if anybody who's not familiar with reading music, those are the ones they are. They're quite short. Anyway, they hadn't paid much attention to the fact that quavers had always to create a harmony between them. Well, that's not very bright, is it? I could figure that out. Then again, I am grade five. the result between Bach made them more dissonant than I suspect they had hoped. Once Joplin's voice came through, she transforms the track, tripping through jazz and blues and pop inflections over the melody, confidently claiming the song of hope for her own. Even Simon, who hated the album so much that he took his name off the credits, called the song exquisitely beautiful. And this exquisitely beautiful song, as you know, played right here, right now, on Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4, by the way. It's just squeezing in a bit of promotion there. There's Big Brother and the Holding Company with Janis Joplin and Summertime. Only 5 more minutes before I have to leave you. Only 5 more minutes before I have to leave Waiheke Radio for a week. Why am I singing so much tonight? I know it's awful, isn't it? I don't know. If you like my voice, I don't know. You're a very demented person if you do. No offense. But anyway, I feel very cruel this evening, very, very cruel indeed. So I'm actually going to leave you with a Yoko Ono track. Yes, I know! It's terrible, isn't it? But anyway, what this one is, Walking on Thin Ice from 1981 in Geffen Records. And it appears on the album Season of Glass. Yoko probably did break up the Beatles. John Lennon frequently said that Ono saved him, and certainly she rescued him as an artist. Almost everything that Lennon did after first meeting Ono was directly influenced by her. The material he wrote about her was the poorer for it. His final sessions, the Double Fantasy album, were a joint effort, but the best elements were clearly honours, just simple but strong ideas compares with Lennon's silly love songs. Ono came from an avant-garde background, working with musicians and composers like Lamont Young, John Cage, and Ornette Coleman. Lennon taught her about pop music, and her best work melds the two worlds. Melds the two worlds. A lot of L's in that phrase. Lennon and Ono were mixing Walking on Thin Ice on the evening that he was shot. And the context reshapes the song into a chilling widow's lament. The tough and unsentimental dance beat that forms the background over which Ono wails the dirge of a widow whose husband is shot in front of her eyes. It is one of the most powerful pieces of pop music. The lyrics are spare and with very pregnant and without platitudes. It's closer to haiku than the Beatles. The music acknowledges the hard edges that were coming out of the post-punk scene. It's visceral and bitter and brutal in ways that most music only pretends to be. You can't take too much of that out of this reality. That's the track I'm going to leave you with. So until next week, or Saturday, I have a repeat at 2 o'clock. You'll be hearing that show. And if you are listening on Saturday, you can tune into my next show at 8 o'clock on Monday. And you can tune into my next show on 8 o'clock on Monday anyway, whatever time you're listening. That's when you can tune in on the same time and the same channel. You can also find my show online at www.waihikiradio.org.nz/1001songs. Or you can hear live streaming at www.waihikiradio.org.nz/listen. Anyway, what I was going to leave you with, I can't even remember now, but I think it was Yoko Ono and Walking on Thin Ice. Here we go.
tried to walk across the lake. Of course it was winter, when all this was ice. That's a terrible thing to do, you know. They say the lake is as big as the ocean. I wonder if she knew about it. Just stop on me.